for Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio.
Ha 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 ha! You don't stop, you keep running. Yeah, you don't stop, you can't run on.
This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I am your host, Scott Horton. The website here, KAOS959.com. Streaming live worldwide on the internet. Want to direct you guys' attention to antiwar.com, of course, as I do every day here on this show. All the worst headlines from all the major papers in the world. Every prime minister that's been voted out. Every peace deal that's been signed or broken. Every conflict worth covering in the entire world, basically. In all of world politics, and particularly with an eye toward violence. It's all there at antiwar.com. Every day, all day, updated in real time, every day. And all my interviews and all the interviews of the great Charles Goyette, the anti-war libertarian radio host out of Phoenix, Arizona, KFNX 1100 AM out there. All of my interviews and all of his are posted in the anti-war radio section there at the top of the page at antiwar.com. And very soon, in fact, I guess you could go there now, antiwar.com/radio. Unfortunately, we were stuck with our own section of the previous anti-war blog, but now we've got our own blog, and I don't think it's quite live yet. Still got some bugs, so I don't think I'm supposed to be announcing that yet or what have you, but yeah, antiwar.com/radio. That's a bit easier to remember than antiwar.com/blog/category/antiwar-radio.php or whatever the hell it was. Antiwar.com/radio for all the MP3s of my interviews and those of Charles Goyette. And you can sign up for the podcast thing and all that kind of stuff. My blog is Stress, thestressblog.com. I've got a bunch of great co-bloggers there picking up my slack. I don't have too much time for blogging lately. But I got Vineyard Saker and Mudshark and Mace Price and all the kooks over there at thestressblog.com helping me out. And so stop by there. Stop by Stress. Leave a comment in the comment section. Strike up a conversation. These guys are brilliant. Seriously, I'll write a little blog entry. It'll be, you know, one sentence and just a link because I'm in a hurry. Not even really write anything, just, hey guys, look at this, click. And I'll come back, you know, the next day or a few hours later or what have you, and there's 25 comments and it's all, you know, master's degree level debate or much higher, really. Great stuff at thestressblog.com. Then scotthortonshow.com is all of my archives going back to 2003, not just the anti-war radio, but the Philip Drew interviews, the old weekend interview show, some stress casts that I did, and the new show, Anti-War Radio. Liberty Stickers is where you can buy propaganda for the back of your car. If you hate the government and you want the people in traffic to know that you hate the government, well, you could buy a sticker that says, I'm a patriot and I hate the goddamn government, and how do you like that? And, you know, there's another 1,000 anti-government stickers, anti-empire stickers, anti-Republican, anti-Democrat, anti-Bush, anti-Hillary, anti-war party propaganda for the back of your car at libertystickers.com. And pay special attention to the Scott Horton section because those are the ones I get a dollar for. Also, yeah. Okay. And MySpace, I never mentioned this, but I should mention this. I have a MySpace page. If you guys are into that stuff, then why not come on over and ask me to be friends on MySpace. It's myspace.com/ScottHorton with an underscore in there because I don't know what I was thinking. But yeah, myspace.com/ScottHorton with an underscore in between my two names there. And that is Horton like Here's a Who, which I heard they're making a new movie about Horton hearing who's. Can't wait. Yeah. So that's all I got to say about that. Many websites for you to look at. Chaos Radio, antiwar.com, Stress, Scott Horton Show, Liberty Stickers, MySpace. Here in just a few minutes, I'll be talking with Andy Worthington. He's the author of the Guantanamo Files. But we won't be talking about Guantanamo. We'll be talking about Jose Padilla, the American treated as though he was one of these guys at Guantanamo. Not that they're any more guilty than him, most of them. But the Jose Padilla case, I'm pretty sure in 100 years the historians are going to write, this is when the American people just gave up. And decided that, you know what, fighting for liberty just isn't worth it. It's just not worth it. Hate to blow my great line that I was saving for the interview, but if they can do this to somebody named Padilla than they can do this to somebody named Smith or Jones or Davis. If they can arrest Jose Padilla's sister's brother and hold him in military detention and torture him, then they can do it to your brother. You understand? And that's the thing that never gets the real attention here, is that there's no real law that would allow for any of this. This is the president claiming that he can make up the law as he goes along, and he can abduct Americans and do with them what he likes. And despite the Supreme Court decisions somewhat indicating to the contrary, this is still in writing. This is the official position of the United States government, that George Bush is the unitary executive, that he is the commander-in-chief of all of us and everything, and can do what he likes. So yeah, Padilla case will surely be one for the history books. Here it was, right in their face, and nobody cared. I guess I'm going to have to get back to this in the second hour, but I'll go ahead and mention it to you now. It's the top story at my blog, thestressblog.com, posted by Vineyard Saker, vineyardsaker.blogspot.com. Iranian Revolutionary Guard commander announces that he is holding 200,000 American hostages. I thought that was sort of newsworthy. Let me find a quote for you from Vineyard Saker's blog. Iran's press TV reports that Iran's former Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps commander says 200,000 U.S. troops are in weak positions in the Middle East, and Iran has identified all their locations. God, and I love this picture of this guy. He looks like one of these war criminals from the Balkan Wars. What a spooky looking dude. Military dudes kind of freak me out, man. This guy, well, you know, the high level officer types. And the comb over especially shows a real thinness of character, doesn't it? I mean, you're going bald. Shave your head, dude. What are you doing? But anyway, so yeah, I tell you this every day, and I don't care if I'm crying wolf, and I don't care if I sound like a kid, and I don't care if, you know, 4 years from now, everybody points and laughs and says, yeah, you were the one who kept saying that there was a danger that there was going to be a war with Iran, and it never happened. And you were the one who said that there would be a danger to American soldiers in Iraq and around the Middle East if there was a war with Iran, and it never happened. Ha ha. I'll be happy to take your ha ha's. I can't wait to take your ha ha's. I'll get a shirt and a hat that says the boy who cried wolf. I don't care. That's fine. It's far better than me being right and this coming to pass. And no, I won't take credit like, oh, well, it must be because I stopped it then. Because I don't believe that I have the power to do that. But I say this pretty much every day on anti-war radio, and I'll say it again. If America bombs Iran, our guys in Iraq are in serious trouble. Did you see Star Wars 3? Do you remember where the Emperor said, it is time to execute Order 66, and all the stormtroopers shot the Jedi in the back? Remember that? That's what's going to happen to our guys in Iran. Our guys embedded with Iraqi troop divisions, the so-called Iraqi army, which is nothing but the Border Corps in American-bought clothes, with M16 rifles. If Dick Cheney bombs Iran, those Shiite militias are going to shoot our guys to death. The ones they can get their hands on. Supply lines are, for intents and purposes, already in danger, if not cut. The Brits just left Basra, not that they ever controlled it. Who's going to protect the supply lines between Baghdad and Kuwait in the event of war with Iran? Think air power is going to do it? think air power is going to be able to prevent the Iranian army from striking back at American forces in Iraq? Think air power is going to stop local Shiite militias from going to war for their friends in Iran? Think air power is going to do it? So, you know, just make sure that you got your shit straight when the pollster comes calling. Yes, we're trying to see whether you think war with Iran is a good idea. Oh, you don't, huh? Well, what if the president says it is a good idea? Oh, now you're for it? Oh, okay, great. When the pollster calls, you remember that the fate of those nearly 200,000 American soldiers is in your hands. If you, the American people, turn Dick Cheney loose on the people of Iran, that is, if there are not super duper majorities screaming that it must be stopped at all costs, the American people give their tacit consent to a war against Iran, the blood of those American soldiers will be on your hands. Bad news. William S. Lynn, military strategist, Marine Corps kind of guy. I forget if he was a Marine or if he just hangs out with Marines all the time, but he's a historian, a military strategist. He wrote an article for the American Conservative. It's called How to Lose an Army. How to Lose an Army. You know what the answer was? Surge into Iraq and then strike Iran. That is how to lose an American army in the deserts of the Middle East. And he says, oh, you don't think it can happen? Let me count for you the 1,000 different armies that this could never happen to in American, in world history that it has happened to. Oh no, but we're America. We're immune from that kind of thing. We can send our military forces around the world to kill anyone we want, and there's never consequences. It always works out just fine, and it will this time too, I guess. I'm late. Let me get Andy Worthington on the phone here. Yeah, Welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and our guest today is Andy Worthington. He's the author of The Guantanamo Files. Welcome back to the show, Andy.
Oh, hi, Scott. Yeah, thanks for having me on again.
Well, it's great to have you on, and it's great to see this morning that you've got your first article written for antiwar.com. We're very happy to have you, sir.
That's great. Thank you very much.
And the article's about Padilla. Now, does Padilla feature very strongly in your book?
Not particularly. I mean, I do mention in the book the story of the American enemy combatants. I mean, you know, the main issue, as I'm sure we're going to discuss, is the differentiation that's made between Americans held as enemy combatants and everybody else who's held as enemy combatants. So
Right.
It doesn't figure particularly. I mean, who I feature more in the book, because he was held in Guantanamo, for a while, is Yasser Hamdi, who you may know the story of him. He was actually born in America but moved to Saudi Arabia and was caught in Afghanistan. And as soon as the authorities realized that they had an American citizen in Guantanamo, they had to get rid of him as quickly as possible. And he was then transferred to a brig, as was Padilla. But in Hamdi's case, they arranged for him to be sent back to Saudi Arabia and
Right.
not to be held for 3.5 years.
Because the court was about to rule that he was going to have access to the federal courts. That's
right,
why they let
yeah.
him go. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I was just curious about that, because I know the focus of the book is really on the foreigners, so the victims of the ghost prisons and of the tortures and all this. And I guess, yeah, I sort of divide the topic the same way as you, I guess, the domestic war on terror versus the overseas one. But it's good to see that you've put this focus, at least for this article's sake, and I guess somewhat in the book, on Jose Padilla. And it is a story that I won't get over, and I don't even mind how redundant this interview might be from the one of Warren Ritchie last week, or, you know, any number of other interviews I've done on this subject.
Right.
This is the most important thing ever. And here's why, Andy, and I'll tell you, and I think you already know because you wrote it in your article. This kid was born in Chicago. He is an American. He was raised in Brooklyn, in New York State. He was arrested, unarmed, by domestic civilian police in Chicago, on American soil, and was held originally as a material witness. This is a guy who, you know, I don't care what any judge or any general or any president says, this is a man who from day one, it was clear, deserved access to the American court system and was denied it.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the key here. If they can do this to a guy named Padilla, then they can do this to Smith or Jones or Davis or anybody else.
Well, absolutely. And which I think is the point at which, you know, some American people who may think that all these kind of things are out there and they're just happening to foreign people who may deserve it. I would take exception to that. I mean, as I mentioned in my article, as somebody British, you know, I'm not immune to the president snatching me if he feels like it. So I think the secondary issue is that, you know, if you extend this outrage to foreigners, then they shouldn't be treated like that as well. But you're dead right. I mean, the issue that should be confronting Americans first and foremost about this is, this could have happened, this could happen to us. And the story, as we haven't really discussed yet, is that he was then transferred to a military brig where he was kept for 3.5 years under circumstances that look very much to me as though they would be defined as torture. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we gotta, when we look at the domestic terrorism cases that have taken place since September 11th, we have to really wonder about the guys at Guantanamo. I know in the Detroit case and in the case of the Lackawanna Six, these guys all got access to the federal court system. In
yeah.
both of those cases, I guess in the Lackawanna case, they were actually threatened, and in the Detroit case, it was at least passed around at Department of Justice headquarters that maybe we ought to treat these guys as enemy combatants because they're going to be so hard to convict because, of course, they didn't do anything.
Right.
And, you know, that makes me wonder, you know, they turn over people to the military when they don't have enough evidence on them. What does that imply about the evidence that they do have against the people at Guantanamo Bay? I mean, as we discussed last time, I think in one of these cases you said they tried him three different times until they finally got the verdict they were looking for.
Right, exactly, yeah. I mean, which they did in several cases. And, yeah, I mean, that in a nutshell, I mean, it's just one of the many examples that we could take, but it's really, it doesn't really fill you with great confidence that when that any kind of quasi-legal system that they set up where they go, no, it's the wrong result, try again. Oh, no, it's still the wrong result, try again.
Right.
You know, it doesn't work like that. That's not how you do it. So, yeah.
Well, and I think in America and probably in Britain, too, we all just love ourselves so much that we think it's just fine. You know, our government, at least here in America, George Bush might as well be Superman or Jesus with the crown of thorns on his head or something to most people. He just can't do wrong. So if it's taking place and he's doing it, and geez, he was democratically elected, so that just kind of means everything that flows from there is right. Even though, when we just stop and think about it for just a minute, one of the things that Americans and English people have to be most proud of is the fact that we don't trust our government, and that we have grand juries, and we have all these appeal processes, and Magna Cartas, and habeas corpuses, and all these wonderful things, because we don't believe that the government is just right because they're doing what they're doing. That, you know, that's the whole point of having a jury trial in the first place, is that the prosecution might not be right here.
Well, absolutely, but I mean, it's also the whole point, which is stated in a kind of unwritten way, but which is very explicitly stated in the founding documents of your nation, that, you know, that you had checks and balances to make sure that the executive couldn't behave as though they were not answerable to anybody. I mean, that's, you know, the Padilla story is yet another aspect of what, if you like, is an even bigger and more crucial picture, that whether directed by the president himself, or, you know, more emphatically directed by the vice president, Dick Cheney, and by advisors to him, people like David Addington, mm-hmm. are people who want the executive not to be answerable under any circumstances to what it does to anybody. You know, and the founding fathers are turning in their graves, I think, at the news of this.
Yep.
You know, it's a crucial issue. And the Padilla case of, you know, of the government deciding that they can put a man in a brig for 3.5 years and, subject into total sensory deprivation, you know, to break him down, it was an attempt to mentally destroy him. The fact that that can happen and that there's no check on it, and as we can see from this, you know, he's been tried on something lesser, he's been convicted, we're going to see what happens on appeal. But the fact that you can write off the whole of that thing that happened is, you know, that should be troubling.
Right.
It should be very troubling to all American people.
Absolutely. And you point out in your article that at the trial there in Miami, basically, this whole 3 years that he spent in the brig in South Carolina didn't exist as far as this trial was concerned. It had absolutely nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, I mean, the way that it appears to me legally, really, is that, you know, kind of he just disappeared for a few years and nobody's allowed to talk about it. I mean, that's effectively what happened, isn't it? You know, is that, you know, from June 2002, when he was handed over as an enemy combatant put in the brig, until the time that he came to trial, he just disappeared off the face of the earth, you know?
And I guess the judge ruled that this wasn't any of the jury's business, huh?
Yeah.
Well, it would be prejudicial, I guess, one way or another. If it was me on the jury, it would mean that, oh, this guy's walking. I don't care if he helped hijack the planes on September 11th. They tortured him. I'm letting him go. And I guess it would be prejudicial in the other sense, too, that, wow, well, if they turned him over to the military, he must be a really dangerous guy. So I can see why, you know, perhaps on both sides they would have reason to not want to include that at the trial. But again, I guess you're still right that overall, what a strange situation. It's kind of Twilight Zone-ish situation. Here's this guy's been disappeared all this time, and it just doesn't come up at the trial in any sense.
Yeah, well, it's still part of this process of, you know, of the government sidestepping by whatever means it takes. Any kind of showdown in a court on the U.S. mainland that's going to deal with the issue of, you know, how do you deal with the issue of using evidence that you have to admit was obtained in ways that is illegal under U.S. and international law. And it's still going around it. They still haven't had to confront it. But that's what hides behind this conviction of Padilla, is at some point this is going to have to be talked about. And I mean, you know, I mean, I think we spoke the last time because I'd written an article where I'd raised questions about some of the intelligence that had been produced as a result of, you know, the high value prisoners, so people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Abu Zubaydah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't honestly say one way or another what truth there is in Padilla's story, the one that we didn't hear, the one that was, you know, the dirty bomb plot. There's certainly, it looks like there's a certain amount of evidence, but this didn't come out in the case as to whether there is. But the other man who was caught up in this, the British resident, Babinyan Mohammed, who's held in Guantanamo, his lawyers are really, you know, really convinced that this was something where he was fingered as an accomplice on this, but this is based on nothing at all. Unlike Padilla, who had been wandering around trying to meet people, Binyam Mohammed, the story seems to be that no, he wasn't. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And when the photos start going around in the prisons, do you know this guy? Have you seen this guy here? He gets caught up in the whole thing. And when he wouldn't admit anything, they took him to Morocco and tortured him. So this whole story is yet to come up that ties all these people together. And where is the real evidence, and where is the stuff that's obtained through torture, and how much of it is actually truthful, and how much of it is completely unreliable, you know, which is the point that you know, you shouldn't be allowing evidence obtained through torture, is because it's unreliable. However much you might viscerally think, you know, let's just beat this guy and get the truth out of him, it doesn't work. So I think this whole murky story that's lying behind all this is quite who did what. It just vanished in a puff of smoke, and it all has to be addressed one of these days.
Well, and there's a lot of reason to be concerned about anything that this guy Abu Zubaydah has said. If I remember right, it was Ron Susskind in the 1% Doctrine quotes George Bush after George Tenet, the former director of Central Intelligence, explained to George Bush that this guy Zubaydah's a nobody, and he was in charge of arranging flights for the women and kids to come to Afghanistan to visit and so forth, but that he wasn't really, you know, a actual high-level Al-Qaeda guy or something. And Bush responded, hey, you're not going to make me lose face on this, are
you?
Yeah,
exactly.
As though
yeah.
Bush has any face to lose. You know, give me a break. But he's announced over and over what a success it is that they captured Abu Zubaydah and how much great intelligence they got out of the guy. And then, you know, he basically deliberately instructed George Tenet, you're not to tell the people anything other than that, because you're going to make me look like a liar, because I am.
Yeah, and also, you know, you've got to keep going at this guy, because, you know, it was basically also Bush saying, I don't believe you. You know, he has got information. You know, apply some innovative new techniques and see what we're going to get. And,
right.
Yeah, I mean, with Zubaydah and with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the amount of information that's come out, how much of it is reliable? Well, clearly not very much, I don't think. But unraveling the story of where all these, you know, confessions have actually led, and how many people they've led to who actually are involved in anything, is a huge story that still remains to be unraveled. And that's, mm-hmm. That's what concerns me, is that it's still not happening. You know, the administration is still managing to avoid having to answer these really very difficult questions. You've tortured people. As a result, people have come up with a load of rubbish, and other people have been caught up as a result of it. How are we going to separate the genuinely dangerous people from all these other people who've been caught up and have done absolutely nothing?
Mm-hmm. And now, I'm kind of puzzled because, you know, this isn't really my mindset, but I guess if I have to put myself in their shoes, they like torturing people because they think it's really fun. You know, Dick Cheney and David Addington. But I can't figure out any other excuse for the policy of torturing people. I mean, do you remember, Andy, the case of the kid who was charged with being a terrorist because a security guard at a hotel in New York City lied and said that he found an airplane radio in his hotel room, and the kid ended up being accused of being a terrorist until the guy who actually owned the radio came looking for it.
Right, okay.
And the kid ended up being let go. This is in the very end of 2001, beginning of 2002. But the thing is, that kid confessed. He said, oh, yeah, I'm Al-Qaeda. I'm part of the Egyptian military. Yeah, that's where I stole the radio from in the first place. And yeah, I'm part of this plot. And they didn't lay a hand on him, really. What they did was they threatened the safety of his brother at college in upstate New York and of his family back in Egypt. And they said, listen, you're going to do what we say or we're going to bring harm to your family. And he said, that's right. Me and, what's his name, Mohammed Atta? Yeah, he's my best friend.
Yeah, well,
and he admitted to everything.
I think that's the thing that, you know, that a lot of people don't understand. I mean, I don't personally understand it. It's never happened to me. But, you know, when people are put in, you know, even in police custody and a lot of pressure is put on them, from the outside people think, well, you know, if you're innocent, why would you ever lie? But what people don't understand is that, you know, psychologically it's been demonstrated that it doesn't take that much pressure for innocent people to start trying to get out of the position that they're in by lying. It seems ridiculous, but it happens.
Right.
So, yeah, it seems incomprehensible, but, you know, people crack under not that much pressure in general, I think, is what we should always look at when all these techniques are applied to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so to go back to Padilla, I mean, these stories that he, you know, that he spent weeks on occasion in this completely blacked out cell with no communication whatsoever. The human beings who were responsible for guarding him made sure that, you know, he got no human contact. His food arrived without him even seeing so much as a human finger pushing it into his cell. A couple of weeks of that, and as I think Warren Ritchie said recently, you know, people would think, oh, you'd get a bit bored in that kind of solitary confinement. No, I think what that kind of solitary confinement can do to people, you know, with the exception of some really, really, you know, people who have reserves to draw on, which are quite remarkable, is that people can't handle it. You start losing your mind in that kind of situation.
Right.
You know, and this is what we're looking at here.
And we know that Padilla was a pretty weak-minded individual in the first place.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, I don't think any of the stories of what he may have been trying to do by hooking up with Al-Qaeda is really anything more than than this former gang member trying to get in with some of the big guys and not really having much of an idea of what he was doing. I mean, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that he shouldn't have been tried properly for the things that he may have done. But the whole big story that was concocted about him is clearly not fulfilled by who he was whatsoever. You know, this is not a major operator.
Well, let me ask you this. I guess, you know, I haven't written a book about it, not yet, and I have a lot of research to do, but I don't believe I've ever seen any actual evidence or heard of any actual evidence that this guy ever left Egypt, that he even went to Afghanistan. Is there any actual proof that this guy was even in Afghanistan at all, Andy?
Well, to be honest, I don't know, you know. I mean, the problem with all the evidence that never ends up properly in front of a courtroom is that, you know, it's never really dissected properly to find out what the truth is.
Right.
And, I mean, that's why, you know, there's a paragraph in the article that you're talking about in Anti-War Today where it came to me that there are actually all these allegations that are being made against other people by all these people, none of whom is kept in, you know, in what we would recognize as proper, legally safeguarded custody, are all making these allegations about these plots. And actually, if you start to dissect all that, where's the truth at the bottom of it? It may be there, but it could equally be that the whole thing's made up. I mean, you know, that's ridiculous. How can you have this as the basis for any kind of justice?
Right. Okay, now help me out. It was 2005, right? That, or maybe early 2006, that the Supreme Court was about to rule on the Padilla case. They had ducked the issue once on technical grounds, jurisdictional grounds, but then they were about to hear the Padilla case at the Supreme Court, and they were going to rule that this guy gets access to the court. So rather than risk the Supreme Court ruling against them, the Bush administration decided to go ahead and tack him onto this indictment of these two other guys and begin a criminal trial in Miami. Is that about right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, the story, from what I understand it, is that when it was first thrown out in, I think it was June 2005 or something like that, the opinion seems to be that the majority of the justices, five of the nine, were going to come down on the government for what they were doing, but it was a technical glitch. It was in the wrong court. which was why it was put aside in the first place. So, yeah, as soon as it started to come back to the right court, then, you know, the majority opinion looked like they were going to turn around to the government and say, look, you can't do this. So, yeah, they dropped it and they tagged him on rather feebly onto another case. And, you know, and from the trial, that seems to be clear that that's what happened. But, yeah, he knew these guys. I mean, I wouldn't presume to know particularly about their guilt, but they'd been monitored for years, and there are all these thousands of transcripts of them allegedly talking in code about what they were up to. Mm-hmm. And that Padilla himself is only heard on 7 messages out of all of them and wasn't speaking in code on any of them.
You know, I wonder, Andy Worthington, author of The Guantanamo Files, I wonder whether they only indicted these two guys so that they could have an indictment to tack him on the end of. I think you're right when you say they were monitored for years. Didn't I read somewhere that these guys had been monitored for 13 years or something? The FBI had been monitoring these guys and not doing anything about
it
them?
It might be that long. I mean, I've certainly heard that it was 8 years, but I mean, it may have been longer than that, yeah.
Well,
which might suggest to you and me that maybe they didn't have much on them, don't you think?
Yeah, like maybe they just needed an indictment to tack Padilla onto the end of, so that's how these guys ended up on trial, too.
So and then the whole package looks more attractive all around.
Right, right. And as you say, these guys are speaking in code, and, you know, soccer ball means explosives and, you know, whatever. But they never accused Padilla of speaking in any of this code, right?
No, they didn't, no.
7 phone calls.
So he was very much tagged on to the end. But, I mean, there also is another issue about, you know, about Arabic translations and people speaking in code when a football means this and that. And there have been plenty of examples of the intelligence services mishearing things, and it doesn't fill me with a great deal of confidence about the whole issue. But yeah, Padilla was tagged on, wasn't he? I mean, yeah, it seems to be.
And you know, it's funny, like, never even mind speaking in code. I'm just thinking of the conversation you and I had right before we went on the air. A couple of misunderstandings back and forth. We have an Atlantic Ocean between us, after all, and half a continent.
Yeah, I'm not used to your accent yet, mate. Slow down.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I say, so Andy, are you ready? Okay, well, that could mean anything, right? If we didn't all know that we're about to go on the air, and that wasn't a code. Ready wasn't a pre-agreed term between us. It was, you know, I didn't really finish my sentence because I figured the rest of the sentence was understood. Are you ready to go on the radio, you know? But if an FBI agent was overhearing that, see, are you ready? They're talking about this or that, and they can just plug any conspiracy theory in the world into our conversation and try to make it fit.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
well,
really
I mean, I have read some of the transcripts where there is something that is along the lines of, you know, are you ready? And you're right. And that's a bit open-ended and vague, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely. I mean, it really could mean anything. It could mean anything. Are you ready for what? Let the FBI agent guess. And see, now here's the thing, too. I want to try to give a little bit of devil's advocate or something here to the state. We're dealing with people who are suicide bombers, right? You can't threaten a suicide bomber with life in prison and think that that's, you know, going to dissuade him. We're talking about people who are trying to commit spectacular attacks in the Al-Qaeda network. And so the whole doctrine is basically preventive law enforcement. We have to stop these people before they attack. That's right. We all wish that someone had stopped Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi before they were successful in the attack on September 11th, etc. But then the question is, you know, how far do we go down the path where we're simply trying people for what they are alleged to have thought?
Right.
You know, we're not even talking about conspiracy to commit a crime as much as, well, look, you know, this guy said that he would commit violent jihad one day, and that's a crime, right? You know, just in and of itself.
Well, no, that would be, I mean, there are elements of that, obviously, in a lot of the things that are going on. But I think more what this revolves about is the fact that they wanted intelligence out of him. They wanted to know what he knew. And they spent a long time trying to get out of him what he knew. And as I say in the article, I'm not sure that we've seen very much of what he actually came up with over all these years. And possibly one of the reasons that we haven't seen any of it is because there's nothing there. It doesn't seem to me that he would have very much information to impart, not really, you know, not being a part of Al-Qaeda as he was presumably considered at the beginning. And if there's any truth in all of the stories, you know, the best that he was this outsider who was really quite inept, but who wanted to get in there. So he could say, well, I met these people and I talked about this. 3.5 years of trying to get information out of him. What could he possibly have had? It's all about getting people and not trying them, but holding them and getting what intelligence you can get out of them. And, you know, and then we get back to the torture story that not following established procedures, which were, for example, established by the FBI over many years, which is that you build a human relationship with people, even if you hate them. You sit down opposite the table with them and you work out what combination of flattery and intimidation works to get them to talk. And as you know, one of the key lines for that to me is that if you're up against these kind of big criminal types, usually they've got a big ego on them as well. And you can find your way. If you're an expert in interrogation, you can find a way to get them to talk.
Right.
They didn't follow that route. In pursuit of intelligence, they started working out how they could drive people to the edge of their mental sanity. And that's not, I don't think, a successful way to do things. So I think the big issue is, instead of pursuing a legal course, which presumably could have been done with Padilla in the first place, they decided there was a bigger story there, he knew more, and they followed this procedure then as to how they were going to do it, which is duress, extreme duress, however much you'd like, you know, that could be a euphemism for torture, in the purposes of intelligence, which of course is what most of Guantanamo and the whole secret prison network is about as well. Is not about law enforcement, it's about extracting intelligence from people. And it was something that started without really an end point, which is why so many people are being released from Guantanamo, because in some ways they've exhausted their intelligence value because a lot of them didn't have any.
Yeah.
But there was no ending put in place. You know, what do you do with these people? You're just going to hold them forever and keep pumping them for intelligence? They haven't got any. So then, yeah. Oh, how do we get rid of them now? We've avoided all the legal stuff. You can go home.
Right, and you know, it makes me wonder how many of these guys were just, you know, simple goat herders or whoever who got kidnapped and sold by the Northern Alliance. Basically innocent people. How many of them are terrorists now? I mean, a pretty simple perusal of the history will show you that Ayman al-Zawahiri and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi both became the terrorists they became because they were tortured by the governments of Egypt and Jordan.
Well, I mean, it's definitely a good point. And I mean, what I would say to that one is that, from the evidence from a lot of the people who've been released, I'm amazed that people who were wrongfully imprisoned and treated in the way that they have been for so long. But a lot of them, you know, have the kind of profound religious belief that doesn't encourage them to want to, join Al-Qaeda. It's actually the kind of profound religious belief that encourages them to believe that, you know, that their God knows best what's happening and that it is not their position to get wound up about this. And the people who remarkably, are released from these kind of situations and do not bear bitterness against the people who've done this to them and, you know, and don't want to tell them and don't want to become terrorists. I haven't seen any evidence whatsoever of anybody who's been released to Guantanamo taking that route. What I think has happened, and the military has played on this one enormously, is that a handful of people, mostly people that were involved in the Taliban already, that they failed to work out that they were with the Taliban because they didn't talk to the right people in Afghanistan. But some of those have been released and have rejoined the battlefield, as the military likes to put it. But, some of the people that are released back into Afghanistan would be maybe people that are coming from a certain background where, you know, there's a lot of rivalries going on and a lot of low-level warfare and stuff going on, and it's not really as simple as they've made out. But it seems to be that if there are any examples, it would be Afghans. And like I say, the part that the military doesn't mention is that quite often they did release Taliban commanders out of Guantanamo because they said to them, I'm a rug merchant, and they believed them. In Afghanistan, there were plenty of people who knew the Taliban who were saying, why did the Americans never talk to us about this? Not at any moment did they say, come to Guantanamo and see who we've got. when they released them, they didn't say, look, just before we release these guys, would you like to have a look and see whether you know any of them? So it was actually the authorities' own fault that they did that.
Yeah, it's just nothing but total incompetence and torture from one end to the other. It's just incredible. And like you say, their thing with Padilla, they weren't frightened of him. They wanted intelligence out of him. And I love this quote. I need to really memorize it. Maybe I'll get it tattooed on my arm or something. Special Agent Russell Fincher. I didn't want to arrest him. I needed his cooperation. They wanted to set up a sting operation and use Padilla, and he refused to go along. And, boy, you know, there's a negotiating tactic you don't usually hear about, but, you know, when you talk about the FBI and the way a professional is supposed to negotiate with somebody like this or interrogate somebody like this, there's kind of an extra, you know, brass knuckles in the back pocket there. Look, kid, cooperate with me or I'll turn you over to Don Rumsfeld.
Right.
You know, and he'll hang you upside down from your toes and beat you. So,
yeah. So
please, by all means, why don't you become a snitch for us?
You know, right.
That's,
yeah.
Boy, you know, if you're really trying to convince me to become a snitch, at least mention that you're going to turn me over to the military before you do. You know, give me one
right.
more chance. Come on. I don't know. Poor guy. I don't know what, you know, how guilty this guy is of anything, but I have to tell you, if it was me on that jury, I would not have gone back there for a couple of hours and come out with a conviction. I'd have gone in there and I'd have told the rest of those jurors, I don't care what you people say, this guy's getting acquitted or deadlocked on all charges. I'm not finding him guilty of anything.
Well, it was a very swift decision, wasn't it? I mean, you know, it was almost no time at all that they took after a 3-month trial. And I think what you mentioned earlier must undoubtedly be a part of this, that, you know, when you've got a story of somebody like Padilla who, you know, who was so kind of notorious in the States for so many years before this, you know, trying to get a jury who had absolutely no idea of any of the backstory, I would suspect is almost impossible, really.
Yeah. Well,
and even if it was, even if you did, I think by the time the prosecutors had managed to do all that stuff they did in the trial, you know, like showing a film of Osama bin Laden, you know, why they were allowed to do that is beyond me. I mean, what has Osama bin Laden and a speech by him got to do with the case that they were looking at? It hasn't.
It's amazing that that was allowed at the trial.
Yeah, I think it is, yeah. But
I think you say in your article that the prosecution, over 100 times in his opening arguments and in his closing arguments, too, mentioned Al-Qaeda.
Mentioning Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, you know. I mean, he might as well have been standing there ringing a really huge bell, I think.
Now, see, I don't know. I like to imagine that if you get 12 people at random deciding your fate, that one of them is going to have some kind of BS detector. One of them is going to be able to say, now, wait a minute, don't patronize me, and don't try to brainwash me with Osama bin Laden footage. Oh, you know, he's not the one on trial here. Seems like somebody out of 12, you'd get at least one person in there who would be determined to hold on to some reason. But no, what was it, you know, 3 or 4 hours or something? They came right out, or the next day they came out with this conviction?
And I mean, you know, from what I understand, the major thing was, you know, this story that apparently his fingerprints were on this application form for a camp. But I mean, if we're going to go back to all the kind of doubts that we've raised earlier as to how much truth there is in the whole of the story that didn't go to the trial, but that has been discussed and was put out by the Department of Justice years ago about what they found out about what Padilla was doing here, there, and everywhere. If it comes down to that all he did was that he was going to apply to a training camp, does that make him that dangerous? I mean, I quite early in the article, I just put this point that having once been put across by the government as, you know, the most dangerous man in America, at the end when he was convicted, he wasn't actually accused of having raised a finger against a single U.S. citizen. And that seems to me, you know, that's not quite right somehow. This probably gets us into those more difficult issues like the Lackawanna Six that I know that you mentioned earlier on, who, you know, who are these young Yemeni-born Americans who had gone out to a military training camp in Afghanistan but had no other involvement with anything whatsoever. I mean, if you look at that, as the from the point of view, and this is contentious, but as a, you know, as a rite of passage for certain young Muslim men, then what do you want to do? You want to imprison every single person who ever went to a military training camp in Afghanistan?
Yeah.
And do you have a cutoff point? Because if you go back 20 years ago, the American government was directly funding those training camps when it was training the Mujahideen to fight the Russians.
Sure, and in fact, you know, even in 1999, using them as shock troops in Serbia and Kosovo.
Well, exactly. Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you're absolutely right. And this is the slippery slope we start going down when we're talking about preventive law enforcement. You're under arrest for something you might do. You're standing in the front yard with the keys in your hand and you've obviously been drinking. I'm going to go ahead and arrest you for driving while intoxicated now because it seems like you're probably about to. And
yeah.
that's the level. And now see, here's the other thing about this too. And never even mind, you know, enemy combatant status in military tribunals. In federal court now, this is the standard of evidence that can get a man convicted. You know,
yeah.
This guy one time went to a place where other people hate America or something. And then that's a crime. And
yeah, no, I mean, I find it very shocking as well. And, you know, yeah, I mean, really shocking. And I mean, I think it's something that, you know, you ought to keep going on about, Scott, actually, is that, you know, are you aware, people, that, you know, that we are getting to a position where, you know, we are convicting people on thought crime?
Right. I mean, frankly, I mean, for anybody who listens to this show and know how much I hate the government, I guess it wouldn't be hard if someone who's a regular member of this audience uses their imagination, why they might be able to come up with a scenario where I would do something violent. And
right.
So now what? You're going to put me on trial? You know,
right.
I hate the state. There, fine. Quote me on that. But now apparently that's enough, I guess, if they want to say that I have some sort of intent to someday do something violent to someone.
Yeah.
Which, you know, this is far beyond, you know, a conspiracy charge, which is usually, you know, too vague for my standard anyway.
Well,
but this is just,
you know, and I think probably one of the reasons that it doesn't bother most people is that they think that it's only, you know, people that they're not that it's happening to. So, I mean, clearly, you know, if you're not a Muslim, then you have plenty of reason to think that, you know, nobody's coming after you because so much energy is being directed about, hey, look at that Muslim guy there. He might be a terrorist. You know, they're not looking at you and thinking you might be a terrorist.
Right.
But I'm sure there are other minority groups in the United States who are getting tackled in exactly the same way that you don't hear so much about. I mean, you know, I know that in this country, for example, the anti-terrorism laws in this country have also been used against animal rights protesters. They've also been used, this is the one that particularly stickens me, they've been used against protesters who have been protesting at arms fairs in London. They have a big arms fair every 2 years in London. You know, which is where all the major arms manufacturers and the governments get together to chuck their billions around, you know, on buying weapons of mass destruction. And protesters there were intimidated and arrested using anti-terrorist laws.
Mm-hmm.
Now, wait a minute, this isn't right, you know. But if you enable your government to be in this position where they can, as you say, start basically, you know, arresting people for what they might do, then the issue is, are you going to sit back and think it's not going to happen to me? Or are you going to take the rather bigger issue is that when you start empowering governments to do that, who is to decide that next year they don't decide, they don't just go, actually, we don't like these guys as well, so why don't we include those?
Right.
And suddenly that could have been you sitting on the sidelines, and the next year it's you. And they're coming and saying, yeah, you're about to do this, and we're going to have you.
Yeah. And, you know, here's the thing that really gets me about this, too, beyond the injustice that's being perpetrated upon these individuals. It's what's happened to our culture, where we're willing to just disregard lessons that we all learned as children. We all know that it's better, what's the old saying, right, Blackstone or something, right, to let 1,000... guilty men go free rather than put one innocent man in prison. Or, you know, if they can do this to this guy, then that means they can do it to you, and it's the principle of the thing. It's, you know, we all learn this as kids in elementary school, and yet if our government tells us, nah, forget that, this is, you know, a crisis, so we're going to do what we want, we just roll right over for them.
Yeah.
It's just incredible.
Well, I think so. But, I mean, I think, you know, I think in two particular instances, you know, and as an American and a British person talking to each other, we've both we've both got issues with this, which, you know, which should make us uncomfortable in our countries. You know, the first one is that your country imprisons per capita, you know, just disproportionately more people than anywhere else in the world.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, far, far, far too many people in prison. Not really doing your society any good by having that many people there, because people don't come out reformed the way the system's set up, so it's more trouble.
Well, you know, I read recently that 25...
We have the biggest per capita population, prison population in the whole of Europe, in Britain. And that, to me, that ought to be a bit of a shame, really. It ought to be addressing it differently. You know, oh, all these people... Are you telling me all these people are that dangerous? If they're not dangerous, shouldn't we be finding another way of dealing with this that isn't quite so destructive to society?
Right.
Or is it all just about punishment? Is it all just about vindictiveness and short-sightedness as far as society goes? And, you know, it should be a bigger issue for both our countries than it is, really.
Yeah. You know, I read a statistic recently. I'm sorry, I interrupt terribly. I read a statistic recently that had it that 25% of the prisoners in the world are in American jails.
Right.
I mean, we have 300 million out of 6 billion people on the planet, and we have a quarter of the prisoners. I mean, that is just, you're right. This is a symptom of society gone mad or something, and, you know, some sort of advanced state of decay where people are willing to just get up and go to work every morning knowing that that's the case and continuing on.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just insane. It is.
Well,
I mean,
and it has. I suppose it has a knock-on effect, doesn't it? Which is that, you know, if you don't allow ex-convicts to vote, then you start rigging your system when you've got that many people who've been in prison. You know, which is another bit of a subtext to the American prison story, isn't it? Is you know, how that's been played by the administration of like, well, none of these guys can vote. Well, it's a huge number of people who can't vote. Great. Because they were all going to vote against us if they could.
Right. Well, and see, that's the thing, is they'd all just vote Democrat, and that wouldn't do us any good anyway. All right. Anyway, you're a great guy, man. I really appreciate this, and I can't wait to read your book. It is now in print. Is that right, Guantanamo Files?
Well, the copies are coming back from the printers this week. I dare say that review copies will be going out in the next couple of weeks.
Wonderful.
It's still another month until it comes out, but yeah.
Okay.
We are getting closer, Scott, so we'll have to talk again in a month, yeah?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I can't wait to get my hands on this thing. It's The Guantanamo Files by Andy Worthington, and you can look up his blog, andyworthington.co.uk, and he's got a great one today on antiwar.com, Jose Padilla, More Sinned Against Than Sinning. Really appreciate your time today, Andy.
That's brilliant, Scott. It's always great to talk to you. Cheers. Thanks.
Take care.
A lot.
Bye. All right, y'all. Welcome back to Anti-War Radio. That was a short one. Here's one more song.
Jerome! Jerome! Put on that
Chaos Radio, 95.9 in Austin,
girl,
Texas.
I wanna go way back. Oh, yeah. Check this out.
When I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid again. Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid again. Back in the days
when I was just a little nigga, I looked up to my bigger bro, begged if I could kick it. So when he went out with girls, I could go tagging along, nagging. If she had a sis, maybe could mac a baby hood rat. Y'all remember way back then when it was 1985, all the way live. I think I was about 10. One of those happy little niggas singing the blues that be all always trying to bag with the shag and karate shit. Saying yo mama black, his mama this, his mama that. Then he get mad and wanna scrap. We stay mad about 10 minutes, then it's like back on a bike to play hide and go get it with the younger hoes by the bungalows. Then switch to playing ding dong ditch when that gets old and too cold to hack it. Threw on a bomber jacket. You can tell the ballers cause they fell wearing gazelles. If they really had money raised, we sport knee case. And all the girls had they Turkish link. If it broke, then they made earrings to it, like they meant to do it. But sometimes I still sit and reminisce then think about the years I was raised. Back in the day,
back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid again. Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid again.
And everybody
back in the
say,
days when I was young, I'm not a kid
and everybody
anymore.
Say,
but some days I sit and wish I was a kid again.
And everybody
back in the
say,
days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore.
What?
But some days
when?
I sit and wish I was a kid.
I'm still back in the days, but now the year is 87, 88. That's when my crew and I were in junior high in seventh grade. I hated school.
Wish it had grown up.
No doubt I couldn't wait to get out
and be a grown up.
But let me finish this reminiscing and telling about when girls were spelling tight corduroys like for the boys, basket weaves, Nike Cortez and footsie socks, and eating pickles with Tootsie Pops. And it don't stop. I'm glad cause when JJ fed it supersonic, it was kinda like a sport to wear biker shorts or to wear jeans. And it seemed like the masses of hoochies had poison airbrushed on they asses. Dudes had on Nike suits and the Pumas with the fat laces, cause it was either that or K-Swiss. I miss those days, and so I pout like a grown jerk, wishing all I had to do now was finish homework. It's true, you don't realize really what you got till it's gone. And I'm not gonna sing another sad song, but sometimes I do sit and reminisce then think about the years I was raised. Back in the day,
back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid again. Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid again.
And everybody
back in the
say,
days when I was young, I'm not
when.
A kid
and
anymore. But some days
say,
I sit and wish I was
when.
A kid
and everybody
back in the days when I was young, I'm not
when.
A kid anymore.
Back
but
in
some
the
days I sit and wish I was
day.
A kid.
And everybody say,
I remember way back when.
And everybody say,
I remember way back when.
And everybody say,
I remember way back when.
What?
Back in the days.
When?
Back in the days.
Well, it's the Niggero. I figure that now I'm all grown up, because I'm 18 years old. And guess you could say I'm holding down a steady job and crew steady mobbing. You steady bobbing your head and I'm paid, so I got it made. But didn't always have clout. Used to live in South Central LA. That's where I stayed and figured a way out. I gave it all I had, so for what it's worth, I went from rags to riches, which is a drag. But now I'm first, so
on our way up.
Yeah, we said that we was gonna make it since a kid, and we finally did. But sometimes I still sit and reminisce, then think about the years I was raised. Back in the
days, back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid again. Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore. But some days I sit and wish I was a kid again.
And everybody
back in the
say,
days
I remember
when I was young,
back
I'm not
when.
A kid anymore.
And everybody
but some
say,
days I sit and wish I was
when.
A kid.
And everybody
you know, one time I interviewed the other Scott Horton, the famous international law professor, author of the No Comment blog. And we talked about how during the Revolutionary War, George Washington caught American soldiers torturing a captured, I forget if it was a British soldier or a German Hessian or something. And he put them up against the wall and he shot them. And he said, this is what happens when someone under my command tortures somebody. I kill you. Is that understood? General Washington said. And see, this is what's got me so pissed off. It's not like I was born and raised in England. I'm not a Russian. I'm not a German or a Frenchman. I'm an American. And I was raised to believe that the legacy of my country was the legacy of rebellion, of independence, of liberty. A country that had its origins in the overthrow of the illegitimate jurisdiction of a criminal empire. Remember tri-corner hats and the Liberty Bell? Give me liberty or give me death and all that. Remember that? Don't fire boys until you see the whites of their eyes. Because we're almost out of ammunition. And now look at us. Look at us. We might as well be the Russians. We might as well be the Germans. Going around like we own this world. Like our government's jurisdiction, you know, is the circumference of the globe. There is no rule of law that binds them. And look, this was brought up in that interview. The president's point of view is that he is the commander-in-chief, period, of everyone, of everything, that his word is law. And don't doubt that. There have been times where he's pretended to respect Supreme Court decisions that said, no, George, you can't do this or you can't do that unless Congress says it's okay. So he goes to Congress and says, okay, Congress, say it's okay. And they do. The Imperial Senate, in their advisory-only capacity in which they now serve, of course, always rubber stamp whatever he requests. But look close. Pull out your magnifying glass and read the fine print. On every one of these laws, he continues to add these signing statements that say, to whatever degree I don't feel like obeying this law, I won't. And how do you like that? And Bruce Fein, who I interviewed on this show just a few weeks ago, who helped write the articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton, who advocates the impeachment of both George Bush and Dick Cheney and their removal from office. I forget exactly what context this was, but this was just in the last week. I read about it at chris-floyd.com. Bruce Fein had a chance to interrogate Bush's lawyer about this, about the recent Protect America Act, where all your favorite Democrats voted to legalize the impeachable and removable offense of warrantless military wiretapping of the American people. And Bush went ahead and put his signing statement even on this Democrat bill that allowed him to continue doing what he was doing. And in his signing statement, he said, I'm the commander-in-chief and I can do whatever I want. And Bruce Fein had the opportunity to cross-examine, not in court, but you understand, one of Bush's lawyers. And in response, it was made perfectly clear that the doctrine of George Bush as Supreme Commander in Chief still reigns. And Bruce Fein tried to say no. The Supreme Court said no, and the Congress said no, and the Congress only said yes to this and not to that. And you have to admit it. Your powers are bound by the law. And Bush's spokesman said, no, they are not. See, we get down, when you're dealing with people like Bruce Fein, you get down to brass tacks. You are bound by the law, he said to the executive branch. And no, we are not, was the answer. And so that lesson that I learned when I was a little kid, that this is America, not Europe, that we have a president, not a king, that he's bound by the same law we are, is all just lies. Of course, it always was lies. I learned that when I was a kid, when Ronald Reagan failed to be impeached and removed from office for waging an illegal war and trading with the enemy. So it was a lie then. But it's certainly nowhere near the truth now. And, you know, pardon me for being a stickler, but what the Constitution says there in Article 2, I think it's Section 4, Clause 2 or something like that. What it says is, the president shall be the commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy of the United States when called into the actual service of the United States by the Congress. It is not his job to set policy. It is his job to retain civilian supremacy over the military, to carry out the foreign policies that Congress directs him to carry out. That is what it says in the Constitution. It does not say George Bush is the commander-in-chief, dot, 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 and therefore has more power than all the czars and Caesars and kings of Europe combined. It doesn't say that. And of course, you all went to government school, so you don't know anything at all about the Constitution at all, except maybe the preamble. Oh, in order to form a more perfect union, we create this government that, I don't know, must be able to do whatever it wants, I guess. Including kidnap and torture and murder people and wage aggressive war. That's in there, right? Abduct Americans and turn them over to military tribunals. That's in there, isn't it? Oh, I'm sorry. All I ever learned about the Constitution was the preamble in high school. Certainly never made the tremendous effort to read all 6 pages of it. Gee, I might have to Google writ of mandamus and find out what that means, and that just sounds like too much of a pain in the ass, so I'm just not even going to bother. Yeah, it says in there that the president is the dictator of the world, doesn't it? Doesn't it say in there he can kidnap and torture and murder anyone he wants, and Congress and the courts can't do a thing about it? Isn't that what it says? Oh, I don't know. I went to a government school where they didn't teach me what it said. Other than something, something, yada, yada, we the people, to create a more perfect union, something, something, right? That's what it says. So anyway, that's why I have a chip on my shoulder about the Padilla case. Fine, he was friends with bin Laden. Fine, he filled out a terrorist application form in Afghanistan. Fine, he talked with two guys who spoke among themselves in some sort of code that nobody can decipher or understand. From the phone, on the phone in Egypt, where he said, "Hey guys, I'm not having a very good time over here. I'm having trouble, you know, learning the local language, and geez, I'm kind of homesick." Okay, fine, all that's true. But don't you see that in America, if the government tortures the defendant, it's your job as a juror to go ahead and let him go? It's your job as a juror to tell the government of the United States, you know what, it's not okay for you to torture people. This man served his time. Does anybody think that Jose Padilla hasn't done his time? Hasn't paid his debt to society? Sitting in solitary confinement for years? Oh, but Abu Zubaydah says he's a really bad guy. Oh, sorry, Mr. President. Abu Zubaydah is nobody. He knows nothing. Hey, shut up, says the President of the United States to the Director of Central Intelligence, according to Ron Susskind in his book, The 1% Doctrine. Shut your mouth, DCI. You're not going to make me lose face on this, are you? You're not going to tell the people that this guy knows nothing. That will make me look like a liar, because I am. But I don't want to look like one, please. Instead, I like Andy Worthington's like, "Hey, don't stop there, Horton. Remember the rest of the story. Torture this motherfucker until he tells us something valuable. That way I won't lose face," said the President of the United States. What? He knows nothing? Well, put some rusty nails in his kneecaps. He'll say something valuable. Yeah, just hold him upside down by his toes and freeze him almost to death. Make him stand for a week and a half. Put blackout goggles over his eyes and gunshot protectors over his ears. And leave him tied in a stress position, freezing on the floor of his cell. Sick some dogs on and beat him with billy clubs. Then he'll give us some good information, instructed the President of the United States to the Director of Central Intelligence. You know, it's funny. This morning I went to get my coffee, and the guy at the Quickie Mart said, "So what do you think of George Bush?" And I said, "Well, I think he ought to be hanging from his neck on the White House lawn." And it's okay for me to say that because Russell Kirk, the founder of modern American conservatism, said the very same thing about his father for much less crimes. So take that and, well, do what you like with it, Secret Service types. I didn't say I would hang him. I said he deserves to be hung on the White House lawn for his war crimes. He is a war criminal. And what I said to the guy at the Quickie Mart was, you know, after World War II, you know what they tried the Germans for? You know what their biggest war crime was at the end of World War II at the Nuremberg trial? Starting a war. That was the war crime. Starting a war. You don't do that. It's wrong to start a war. Wow. Now, you know, welcome to my brilliance, right? Wow, this guy, Scott Horton, is so insightful. He figured out that it's wrong to start a war. What's funny is I'm flashing back on people telling me, oh, what are we supposed to do? Just sit back and wait for them to hit us first? Well, yes. Iraq never attacked America. Yes. Wait for them to hit us first, then you kick their ass. As though there was some sort of imminent something coming from Iraq that needed to be prevented or preempted. Preposterous. Yeah, I'll tell you what, I'll go you halfway. How about this? As soon as Iraq has a navy, and as soon as that navy is on its way to, you know, do a D-Day invasion in Georgia or South Carolina down there or what have you, I say go ahead and bomb their asses in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. There you go. There's preemptive war for you. Send our bombers out to kill them on the high seas on their way here. But, oh, what's that you say? Iraq had not one boat in its navy that did not exist? Oh. It's wrong to start a war. That's why the Nazis were hung from their necks for starting a war. You wonder why I'm so pissed off. Here's America is an empire. America that was founded in rebellion from empire. America that served as an example to poor downtrodden folks all across the world. Hey, look, those Americans actually won their independence from Britain. Let's be like them, they said. And that's real, too. You know, I mean, obviously there's a lot of propaganda. But America really was like the shining light of liberty on earth for people around the world. No more. They don't picture the Statue of Liberty anymore when you say USA. Now they picture a naked guy being held by the night shift on a leash like a dog being dragged around the prison floor. That's what they picture now. Shock and awe and high explosives raining down on helpless civilians. That's what America means to the world now. And again, I'm sorry to be so simplistic about this. There's nothing highly intellectual here. You know, it's funny to read my blog and then go to No Comment and read the other Scott Horton's blog. He's like, you know, Francis Bacon once said, and it's got all this, you know, super duper high class intellectual stuff on it. Not me. I'm simple and to the point. America is not Russia, and it ought to not act like Russia. Huh? How about this one? America is not England. America declared its independence from England. America took the rights of the Englishman, the greatest tradition of individualism in law in world history, and improved upon it, and wrote it in stone. America's not supposed to go around the world acting like England. The American Marines and the American Army are not supposed to be the red coats, issuing writs of assistance, kicking in people's doors, and searching their belongings. America's not supposed to be like Germany, going around starting wars with people. America's not supposed to be an empire. America is supposed to be a limited constitutional republic, at peace. You know, I saw Robert Kaplan last night on PBS. They did this whole special about the American Empire. I saw the title, American Empire, now on PBS. Wow. All about American Empire, huh? This ought to be interesting. Oh, I see. It's about the adventures of Robert Kaplan from the Washington Monthly, traveling around the world, taking the U.S. military Potemkin tour of the fringes of American Empire. Oh, never mind Iraq, never mind Afghanistan. Those get reported on way too much. Let's go to some of the further reaches of the American Empire. And let's call it what it is, an American Empire. And let's celebrate it with Robert Kaplan on PBS TV. That's right. Here's our soldiers doing wonderful things for wonderful people in Mali, in North Africa. Here's America intervening in a civil war in former Soviet Georgia. Aw, isn't that sweet? Look how welcome we are here. They love us here. Here we are, still, 110 years later, killing people in the Philippines. Let's take the tour on down to Colombia, where humanity has been working so hard to try to create a strong central authority, and it's just not working. How many more billions of dollars must be spent to help the national government of Colombia ensure a monopoly on authority in that country? How many more American helicopters must be bought at double their market value, at no big contracts by the U.S. Pentagon? How many more Colombians will have to die at the receiving end of American firepower before finally the dream of a strong central authority can take hold? It's really something else. I encourage everybody to watch this. I hope they rerun it. Robert Kaplan, traveling around the world, surveying the outer reaches of American Empire, and loving it, and justifying it, in ways that to me are just pathetic. Well, you see, Robert Kaplan explains, without a strong central government, oh, people just won't even get up in the morning. That's what he says. They just won't get up in the morning or do anything. You have to have a strong centralized authority. Only then can people live the dream of human liberty. Amazing, amazing. I really love listening to collectivists who have no idea how much like a Russian or a Nazi they sound like, espousing these collectivist state first principles, with no idea at all, no conception that what they preach is the antithesis of what is supposed to be, what is advertised to be the American way. You guys love it, right? That's music to your ears, isn't it? You have to have a strong centralized authority. Only then can people be happy and free. And so America's quest is to travel around the world as an empire. And let's face it, Kaplan says, there's nothing else to compare us to other than world empires in the past. And we must use our might to create stability around the world. Yes, here we are in former Soviet Georgia, where Abkhazia and South Ossetia are attempting secession. They would rather be allied with the Russians and not dominated by the central government in Georgia. Well, what can the American government do to help the government, the central government of Georgia, conquer and control the people of Abkhazia and South Ossetia? Didn't you know that Abkhazia and South Ossetia are your responsibility? Didn't you wake up thinking this morning that in former Soviet Georgia, which I know you can't find on a map, that there's a secessionist movement that has absolutely nothing to do with terrorism or any other pretended national interests of this country? Didn't you wake up this morning thinking that you ought to give your son's life to go stop those darn South Ossetians from achieving independence? Isn't that what America's about? Helping the government of former Soviet Georgia put down secessionist movements? Isn't that our legacy here? The red, white, and blue? Don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes. Isn't that our tradition here in America? I sound naive, don't I? America's been propping up dictatorships around the world for 150 years. Yes, that is the American way, in fact. Now we travel to mysterious Mali. Come on, everybody. Where in the world is the American Empire? Oh, see, here in Mali, these Marines are passing out eyeglasses. The locals just love us. Now, this is how to conquer people. You don't conquer them. You make them think that they want you here. And the way you do that is by giving them eyeglasses. Here we are in Colombia, where we've set up a small clinic and invited some poor people to come in and get a minimal amount of health care. Now, this is how you wage an empire. You don't go in and kick down the front door and turn the place to rubble like Bush did it in Iraq. No. You have to prop up local right-wing death squads and pass out welfare to the peasants. Isn't that the American way? Isn't that what the American Marine Corps is for? Traveling to third world countries and bribing their populations with the American welfare state? Now we travel to the Philippines. Is it true Ramzi Youssef was once here in 1995? Well, no wonder we're justified in helping the military of the Philippines fight against these locals. And again, it's because of the wonders of American welfare statism that these people finally accept us now. You see, America, Robert Kaplan explains, is fighting a global insurgency. And the way to undercut that insurgency is to divide the insurgents from the population. And the way to do that, give them all welfare. Put the whole world on the American dole. You never believe. It's just amazing and wonderful to see how successful our Marines are with their social engineering projects. They are just great at handing out eyeglasses and giving simple medical checkups to peasants. And this makes them love us. I know what you're thinking. Screw Robert Kaplan. An American empire? That's insane. Who does this guy think he is? Max Boot? What are we doing in South Ossetia? The hell are we still doing occupying the Philippines? Why are we propping up right-wing death squads in Colombia? Why? You might ask Robert Kaplan. Well, the answer is because if it's not us, someone else will do it. And if America doesn't rule the world, it could be the Chinese or the Russians. Is that what you'd prefer? Robert Kaplan asks. Is that what you would prefer? That the old Russian Empire come back? Because that's what's going to happen if America doesn't rule the world. Or Europe, he says, but no, then he strikes that and says, no, well, of course Europe can't because they just haven't been making the defense expenditures to get it done. Oh, really? But that truth does not apply to Russia and China, huh? I guess my nightmares are supposed to just run wild about Russia and China taking over the world. Pardon me if Robert Kaplan's conspiracy theory is, you know, 35 or 40 years too late. But oh no, the Russians and the Chinese are going to take over the world. Oh, the Europeans? No, not so much, because they're not spending the money on the military that would be necessary to take our place. Oh yeah? Well, that was a nice lie by omission, Mr. Kaplan. Are you attempting to imply that the Russians and the Chinese are spending enough money to take America's place ruling the world? Because I'll have you know, in case you don't, that they spend less on their military than the Europeans do. Uh-oh. Well, damn. Boy, you know, the excuses for American imperialism are running really thin. If we don't rule the world, someone else will, huh? And if China had, I don't know, tremendous influence in the Middle East and or North Africa, what? You know, steal all the oil for themselves? This actual liquid resource is not going to travel world markets any longer, huh? Is that what anybody thinks? Or is the problem that certain favored politically connected American oil companies won't be the ones doing the pumping? See, it really doesn't matter who's doing the pumping from your point of view or my point of view unless you happen to work for an American oil company. Then you would rather be the one doing the pumping. To you and me, it doesn't really matter, does it? To you and me, the oil gets to market either way. But no, America's the indispensable nation, like Madeleine Albright said. As she complained to Colin Powell, what's the good of having this wonderful military if we can't use it? Come on, let's do this. And so, you wonder why we're stuck on this path of permanent warfare. It's because people like Robert Kaplan represent the other side of the argument in American foreign policy. You can either have empire or you can have empire. You can either bomb them back to the Stone Age or you can bribe them all off with American welfare. Those are your choices. American Empire or American Empire. You can have Max Boot's Empire or you can have Robert Kaplan's Empire. And just so nobody's mistaken into thinking that somehow the Democrats have caught this virus from the Republicans, I'll remind you that it was the Democrats who cemented this world empire. It was the Democrats that got us into World War I. It was the Democrats that got us into World War II. It was the Democrats who started the big phony Cold War against the completely paper-thin Soviet menace. It was the Democrats who got this country into Korea and into Vietnam. And it is the Democrats, all of whom, except for Dennis Kucinich and Mike Gravel, all the rest of the Democrat senators running for president of the United States right now, are proponents of the theory that America must dominate the world. All of them. By hook or by crook, one way or another. That's what they believe. And in fact, I think a case could be made, at least the libertarian strand of conservatism has opposed interventionism, and that, frankly, the right-wing nationalist imperialist types have made an alliance with a bunch of left-leaning intellectuals. Hell, Ledeen and Michael Ledeen and Richard Pearl are still Democrats, always have been, and they'll tell you. So you could call it a right-wing foreign policy. It's certainly not a conservative one. And frankly, you know, we should stop kidding ourselves. America's moving directly into fascism. I guess it's already happened. I read Chris Floyd, chris-floyd.com. It's about heartbreaking. And he's got this great analogy about, it's sort of like an October evening when autumn comes. And that first weather front passes and the cool air of fall comes in. Everything's the same, but everything's different. It's past. It's already happened. The rule of law, the old republic, as it once was, is already dead. In fact, as Chris Floyd wrote it, right now we're in the coffin with the corpse underground doing this debating. It's already done. America as the redcoats. How do you like that? America with the writs of assistance. America turning over American civilians. Never mind those foreigners. Everybody knows if you live across water from here, somehow your natural rights disappear. Never mind them. American citizens being turned over to the military. Tortured. When they finally do get a trial, it's the worst kind of kangaroo trial. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, before you go deliberate here, watch 15 minutes of Osama bin Laden going on and on and on about something that you can't even understand what he's saying that has absolutely nothing to do with the accused in this case. Thank you very much. No alternative to this, says Robert Kaplan. This is how things must be at this point in history. America must dominate the world. Because if we don't, what might happen? That is the modern American liberal ideology at its most blatant, at its most open and honest. Power first. Central authority first. Then it may be possible for humanity to flourish. So you see, our mission is clear. Establish central authority. Period. All other good things in life flow from that first premise. That is the foreign policy and, for that matter, the domestic policy of the modern American liberal. Come on, guys. Let's go occupy Timbuktu. Like every empire in the history of the last 500 years. Come on. Last 1500 years. Come on. Timbuktu belongs to us. That's where soldiers from small towns in Alabama and Texas and Tennessee belong, isn't it? Occupying imperial outposts in Timbuktu. But you see, there's no strong central authority in Timbuktu, and we've got to establish it, or else things will be unstable, says Robert Kaplan. I urge you guys to, look it up. It's probably the whole thing's online now, right, at PBS. Once they run it on TV, they put it online. Go look up Robert Kaplan and the case, the liberal case for American empire. You may want to keep a paper sack or plastic bag, maybe a bucket or something handy in case you have to regurgitate some of your recent eatings. It really is that bad. I'll try to find a link to it and put it up on the stress blog later in the day. So anyway, I got an update from Vineyard Saker. At the top of the first hour, I was sharing with you the recent statement by Major General Yahya Rahim Safavi, the former commander of the Pasdaran, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And I mentioned, this is the former head. It's not the current guy, at least. Huh? Oh, pardon me, Vineyard Saker corrects me. This man has been moved up. He is the main military advisor to the Ayatollah Khamenei. Major General Yahya Rahim Safavi has said, hey, we have 200,000 Americans in weak positions all over the Middle East, and we know where they all are. So don't you worry, America's not going to touch us. Well, let us hope that he's not misunderestimating Dick Cheney. I've been trying to tell you people, if America bombs Iran, our soldiers in Iraq are in deep trouble. Now, frankly, Patrick Coburn, whose judgment I trust, said, it probably won't be an outright, you know, slaughter, all of them shot in the back kind of thing. But what it will mean is that there is no safe area of Iraq at all. It will mean that the Shiite South is in basically at least the same state of rebellion as the Sunni Triangle. And as William S. Lynn, the military strategist, says, our army is penny packeted all around Iraq. There is no American field army in Iraq. They are penny packeted around at all these little bases all over the place. And the Iranian government is now bragging, we hold 200,000 Americans hostage. What? Come on. Bring them on. The Iranians are saying. And do you think that George Bush and Dick Cheney don't know that there's a threat to our soldiers in Iraq? Do you think that they don't know that our guys are going to have Iranian loyal factions at their back in Iraq on the day the bombs start falling? Impeachment is off the table. No, it would be a terrible thing to consider impeaching and removing the president and vice president of the United States. It's just too drastic a measure. Right? You let Dick Cheney bomb Iran, you're going to lose not 3,500 soldiers in Iraq. You're going to lose a hell of a lot more than that. And look, I know that John Kerry is the worst of the worst, but, you know, George Bush beat him by a couple million votes, right? 56 million Americans turned out to vote for George W. Bush in 2004. I wonder if you do the poll. Did you vote for George Bush in 2004? I wonder what percent will say, oh, hell no, that really did. Boy, taking responsibility is really hard in this country, isn't it? We just can't do it. Oh, what I did? Yeah, that's that other guy's fault. Oh, the war? Nah, I was never for it. I think I told y'all about that poll that came out, where it was, you know, what, high 60s supported the war on the eve of war. And now less than 50% will admit that they supported the war ever. Hey, what's so hard about that? Hey, I was wrong. Nope. Just can't admit you ever supported the war, huh? Oh, now you don't like it. Now you want to rewrite your own history, your own life. To a random pollster who's not even, you know, keeping track of your name. It ain't going in your file. They're just looking for raw numbers. Somehow, a majority of the American people supported this war then, but now only a minority did then. That's hilarious to me. All right, so I only have about 10 minutes left, and there's a ton of stuff I wanted to get to, but really, I've been kicking myself because I sort of think that what I really ought to be doing for 2 hours on this show every day between now and next fall is I ought to be talking about Ron Paul. I ought to be telling you everything I know about Ron Paul, because everything I know about Ron Paul is good. Everything I know about Ron Paul is, you know, basically would be him boasting if it was him saying it. Ron Paul opposes torture. If Ron Paul was the president of the United States, the government wouldn't torture people anymore. And any government employee who did torture someone would be punished severely. If Ron Paul was the president, the doctrine of the unitary executive theory would be in the trash. Along with every executive order and signing statement along those lines. If Ron Paul was the president, he would be probably right now giving a speech to the Congress saying, "All right, everybody, I would like you to pass a bill repealing the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security Act, the Military Commissions Act, all the revisions to Posse Comitatus and the Insurrection Act. I want an omnibus reinstate the Bill of Rights Act, and I want it on my desk now." That's Congress being, that's Ron Paul as president being a bully to the Congress. "I demand you take power away from me this instant," he would say to them. No more torture. No more undeclared war. No more empire in Georgia and the Philippines and Colombia and Mali. No more proxy war in Somalia. No more occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. And in fact, the closing of the over 700 and something, really closer to 1,000 American military bases around the world. They would be closed. And the American occupiers in Korea and in Japan and in Europe and in the Middle East, in Africa, in Latin America, would all be coming home if Ron Paul was the president. The Bill of Rights would be intact if Ron Paul was the president. The separation of powers would be just fine. At a recent debate, they asked all the Republican candidates, "Gee, will you restore honor and integrity to the White House?" And they all said, "Oh, yeah, yeah, the fact that I have no honor and no integrity whatsoever, notwithstanding, I absolutely will." And then they came to Ron Paul. And with honor and integrity, he said, "Look, I'll promise you this, I will not use executive privilege to keep information from the Congress. It's their responsibility to know what's going on in my government. It's my responsibility to tell them everything." He didn't talk about himself. He talked about what he would like to do with his power, which is give it away. Which is give it up. Because, of course, he has honor and dignity. That was his answer. No more military commissions. No more enemy combatant status. No more sneak and peek searches of your house and bugs on your keyboard. No more United States military tapping your telephone. No more bogus terrorism trials of innocent men entrapped by the FBI and their informants, testified against by liars. No more of that. I sort of look at this like we got one last chance here, guys, and that's it. I was reading Chris Floyd the other day, and Chris Floyd is saying, "Oh no, pal, the Republic is dead. It is buried. You and I are now sitting on the corpse discussing this." I want to say, wait, Chris Floyd, is there not one more chance? Do the American people not have one more chance to try to set things right? To restore the rule of law in America? To have a limited constitutional republic instead of an empire bent on self-destruction? Don't we have one more shot at this? Perhaps we don't. Perhaps it really is far too late. You know what Ron Paul reminds me of? Did you guys ever see that movie, America with a K? 5-part miniseries that ran on ABC in the 1980s. It was sort of the the John Birch Society paranoid conspiracy theory about the United Nations and the Soviet Union taking over America. The movie takes place in 1997, 10 years after the phony election, almost 10 years after the phony election of 88, where the Republican and the Democrat were both KGB. And Kris Kristofferson, as in, you know, me and Bobby McGee, Kris Kristofferson is the hero. He's the Ron Paul of the movie. And later, you know, chapter 4 or 5 of the miniseries, we learn that he ran for president in 1988 as an independent. He said, look, we already have Soviet advisors in this country. The forms of our government are already falling apart. This is our last presidential election. This is our last chance to try to regain our freedom, everybody. You know it, and I know it, and the media knows it, that the Republican and the Democrat here are both KGB, that we have one last chance to elect somebody who's not, and that's me. And I'm begging you, please. And of course, the American people did not support Kris Kristofferson, and he went off to the concentration camp, and the KGB won the election in 1988 in the movie America with a K. It's not called America with a K. It's called America. It's spelled with a K. You dig what I mean. I think that's where we are right now, right? We got our Kris Kristofferson, our one last chance to elect someone who is not ultimately a traitor to the people of this country. One last chance to elect someone who is not a traitor to our Constitution, to our Bill of Rights, our very way of life. Are we going to take the chance? Are we going to go ahead and vote for the KGB guy? You know, go ahead and vote for Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or Rudy Giuliani or any other of these bloodthirsty imperialist warmongers who want nothing but to control the power themselves. You already know the answer, and so do I. And it's a hell of a thing. But you know what? There's hope. In fact, even in that movie, America, Kris Kristofferson was one of the big reasons that anybody was still willing to fight after 10 years of occupation. So, you know, in every failure of liberty to withstand power, new seeds are sown for resistance for later. But, you know, I don't know. I probably am not doing Ron Paul any favors by talking about him. I get up here and talk about how much I hate this and hate that all day long, and then I talk about Ron Paul. Maybe sounds makes him sound like a hater. Well, he's not. I really don't believe Ron Paul hates anybody. But I know he loves liberty. I know that for a fact, and that's why I trust him. I do trust him. I trust a politician, Ron Paul. I think if somehow he could get the Republican nomination, I think he could beat Hillary Clinton's ass. Because she's a bloodthirsty, warmongering imperialist, and a lot of the Democratic base is not. And Ron Paul has opposed the war with Iraq since 1998. And he was right all along, everything he said about it all along. So, you know, there's something, just tactically speaking, Republicans out there, there's only one Republican who can beat Hillary in the general election, and that's Dr. Paul. That's Ron Paul, MD. He's the only one who can beat Hillary Clinton, you understand? 70% something of the American people are opposed to this war now. You cannot elect a Giuliani or a Romney over Hillary Clinton. You can't. The only person who can beat Hillary Clinton is the anti-war Republican, the anti-empire Republican, the pro-Constitution, pro-Bill of Rights, old Republic, not empire Republican, and that's Ron Paul. And, you know, the fact that Republicans are stupid, and that's why they're still Republicans, is a fact that is discouraging, but what are you going to do? Got to try our best. And I'm sorry that I didn't have more substantive to say about Ron Paul, except that I love him, that I trust him, that I believe that he believes in liberty. We'll try to do more to really cover Ron Paul in substance. But of course, all you have to do is go to antiwar.com/Paul. And you can know all these things firsthand for your very own self. All right, this has been Anti-War Radio. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Be back here tomorrow, 11 to 1. Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin.
Thank you.